news and features from around Australia and around the world. This is Travel Radio Australia. Here's your host and travel guide, Ren Zviers.
And a big welcome to the show this month. We are running a little bit late this month. Oh dear, slap over the wrist. But unfortunately, well, fortunately for me, I've been travelling overseas, so haven't been able to get to the studio for the last couple of weeks. But we'll fix that all up now. We're ready to roll with a brand new show. We'll have Jeff Harrison visiting McGave in France, and he chats with Julian Marjon. And travel writer Radio's Graham Kemlow is going to be interviewing regular contributor Kirsty Bedford about her brand new position as editor of Luxury Escapes. Then on the show, Travel Bites host David Gordon is in the Czech Republic, where he meets Neil from Eating Europe Tours. And to complete the show, Arthur von Wiesenberger from Around the World Travel Radio and TV and his good mate Richard Torren reminisce about their recent trip to Barcelona, Spain. That's all happening ahead in Travel Radio Australia. Starting off the show, though, here's Jeff Harrison in France.
We're here in Megève in France, and I have with me Julian Marjon from the fantastic Alpago restaurant, and it's someplace you really should visit if you're coming to Megève. Julian, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Jeff. Welcome to you. Welcome at the hotel. To mention and explain a little bit, we are a small hamlet based a little bit outside of Megève, but I think that's our biggest strength. We offer two offerings in our food and beverage. Of course, La Table de l'Alpaga with one Michelin star, with our executive chef Anthony Biscara, and on the side, the bistro, which is executed also by our executive chef, but on a more casual way. So please be welcome to our hotel.
Well, it's very chic. It's very modern, but with an old feel as well. You've got both going on here.
Absolutely. We try to be trendy, and I think that's the main word for the hotel. But at the same time, we keep also the tradition of the Haute-Savoie, so the region, and the decoration of the chalet will be more on the contemporary style, and the hotel more on a more puppy and modern style. So that's the offering.
Julian, tell us about the chef here and the type of food that people can have if they come to the restaurant.
Yes, Anthony Biscara, it's a young executive chef. He was a sous chef at the hotel before taking the full role. We give him the opportunity in order to carry on our Michelin star, because we have been awarded this Michelin star in 2014 already. And he's keeping along this award and doing an extremely good job. His main focus will be on the local product, but we need to know that Anthony is also from the Basque country. So there is always a little touch from the Basque, from his own region.
Yes. Excellent. So what kind of people do you have coming here? I suppose all sorts of people, and I suppose you've had some pretty well-known ones on occasion too. Yeah.
Of course, unfortunately for confidentiality, we'll keep the names, yeah. But yeah. We had some very famous actors actually from the UK renting a chalet last winter, and also some modern lifestyle and I will say on the fashion branch. Of very important guests coming to the hotel also. But our customers are mainly from France and UK, and then we do have a mix with different nationalities.
So I suppose the UK market for you is very, very important, the skier market for you.
It is crucial, and we are talking about winter, but we forget Megève about the summer. And there is, as you probably think, more activities in summer than in the winter. Winter, of course, we've got all the snow events and snow activities, but in the summer, a lot of the activities are adding. We've got the powerglading, we can have some rafting, canyoning, etc. And very nice walk that you can start also from the door of the hotel.
And there's a couple of major events that I know happen in Megève every year. You have the Jazz Festival and the Gastronomy Festival, which I suppose that you're very heavily involved in.
Absolutely, and that will be, well, mainly involved as a hotel, but the person who is the most involved, of course, is Anthony. And we're participating to this event in October, and for sure the different Megève Jazz Festivals along the year. And one event which is also extremely important, that's the jumping. Jumping is taking place on the third week of July. Very prestigious event, very nice horses and very nice riders also coming to that.
This is the show jumping, yes, very
absolutely.
Good.
Yes, also, we don't need to forget that we've got a golf and there is also a ball trap. And for your information, 2 years ago, Megève welcomed the World Championship of shooting. So that's a very live station, even if we are very small, very traditional and very pretty. But there is a lot of activities on the side also in order to promote the village.
Can you give us a little bit of a recommendation for the restaurant here of your couple of your favorite dishes that people should try if they come along?
Absolutely. One of them will be the mushroom. That's one of the starter created by Anthony. It's becoming now a signature dish. That's a starter. It's all based on the, on a special flour with the egg yolk, which is confit, and then there is a sauté of mushrooms on it. And that's one of the main and more popular dishes. Now we need to talk also about the farcement. Farcement is a local dish, and Anthony tried to develop this classical recipe, which was very heavy, and he developed it as a garnish also for meat or fish, adapted to a more contemporary style, going also with the idea of the hotel.
Perfect. And could you give us all the website for the hotel, how people can find you online?
Yeah, that's www.alpaga.com. I just need to mention that we are part of a small group, a trendy group. We've got actually two hotels also in Val Thorens, which is the Val Thorens on 4-star and the Fitzroy in 5-star. We don't need to forget also Les Trois Vallées in Courchevel, 4-star, the Alpaga, of course, on 5-star. And we've got a new addition who came 2 years ago, and that will be the third edition for this summer. That's Les Roches Rouges in Saint-Raphaël. Voilà, so a small group, small brand, extremely luxurious on the lifestyle, and working very well. So hopefully we'll welcome a lot of you. Thank you. And I just have one thing to add at the end. I suppose you're familiar with Snow Camp,
yes.
And we've got an association with Snow Camp. So all the hotels are supporting this association. And actually, we welcome also a few young people in Val Thorens this year in order to make them in the hotel industry and for them to discover something different and maybe a vocation. We'll see.
Perfect. Thank you very much. And enchanté. And we'll see you all here at Alpaca in Megève.
Wonderful. Thanks to
you. Okay, Jeff Harrison reporting from France. Australia's frequent flyers have voted on the best airline rewards program, with Qantas frequent flyer taking the top spot on a national level. But Velocity frequent flyer, the preferred program in some states and among younger flyers. Interesting. The findings come from a poll of 1,686 frequent flyers who are community members on pointhacks.com.au, which is an independent platform for one of Australia's biggest pool of frequent flyers and rewards point experts. The community was asked to vote for the program that delivers A, the best flight availability, and B, the best points per flight values. The Qantas Frequent Flyer program secured the most votes nationally, 33% of respondents, followed by Velocity. However, frequent flyers in Queensland, the ACT and Tasmania rated Velocity as number one. That's 34, 55 and 48% of voters in those states respectively. Singapore Airlines' KrisFly program came in third place, with a quarter, 25% of frequent flyers finding the best value in this program. Interestingly, lower income earners, more than high earners, voted Velocity as the leading program. 35% of voters earning less than $50,000 annually preferred Velocity against just 23% of the same income earners who voted for Qantas. However, KrisFlyer might be a little known secret among higher income earners. It was selected as the number one program by 40% of respondents in investor and shareholder roles. Daniel Skiberis, PointHack's spokesperson and frequent flyer expert, says the results reflect not only the value of the points and availability of flights in these programs, but also the different factors that can affect this. Qantas still has the majority of corporate contracts, which could account for Victorian and New South Wales residents ranking the Qantas frequent flyer program the best due to travelling with the airline for work. If you're flying on one airline for work, it's more likely you'll also fly with them for personal travel. Gold and Platinum members may also favour this program as they have access to a Platinum Lounge in Sydney and Melbourne, while Queensland and South Australia only have a General Business Lounge. Velocity was voted the best by Queenslanders, potentially due to Virgin being the predominant carrier in Gold Coast, and Virgin being headquartered in Brisbane. Crestflyer, on the other hand, may be more popular among higher income earners as they offer a very premium product. Singapore Airlines created and were the first to introduce the Suites class, which has strong appeal for higher income earners, which allows them to retain their customers. Next on the show, we have Travel Writer Radio's Graham Kemlow interviewing regular contributor Kirsty Bedford about her brand new position as the editor of Luxury Escapes.
And that's to introduce Kirsty Bedford, one of our team who's moved on to bigger and better things here. She's editor of Luxury Escapes magazine, whose contents are read by more than 3 million digital subscribers every issue. So we'll be speaking with Kirsty on a semi-regular basis about the latest trends in luxury travel. And even if we can't afford it always, I guess it is something inspirational. Welcome back to the show, Kirsty.
Thank you, Graham. It's nice to be here.
Now, we chatted with you before about some of the trends evident in the luxury end of the travel market. Now, I know not everybody can afford a luxury experience every time, but I think at least we can aspire to something. So what are you seeing as you move around the world? What are you seeing as the sort of places that are hot now for luxury escapes?
There definitely are some places that are pretty hot right now, and it does vary, obviously, depending who you talk to, but there are some that are consistently coming up, and those ones are Bhutan because of the nature, and there's also been quite a major investment by Six Senses, which opened its first three lodges there recently. It's got quite a big focus on sustainable tourism, which is also becoming quite increasingly important to sort of the luxury end of the travel market, because they're doing things like, you know, management of energy consumption and waste and that sort of thing. Other countries we're seeing with real growing interest are Portugal, Turkey, Rwanda, and India, Sri Lanka, which was obviously recently
ranked in the magazine, isn't it, this latest issue?
It is, actually. I went to Sri Lanka and stayed at a gorgeous property down in the south called Anantara Peace Haven Tangell. And there is a story on that in the latest issue of Luxury Escapes magazine, which is out now. And basically, that's a print magazine that's out in newsstands in Australia and New Zealand. And basically, Sri Lanka was ranked top country to visit in 2019 by Lonely Planet because of all of, sort of the diversity available there and the sort of things I experienced when I stayed there, particularly down that south, which is because that property's on such a stunning beach. Obviously, there's a lot of time that can be spent there, but also very close to there are a lot of experiences like temples and tea plantations and a national park. And I guess one of the other sort of really big places we're seeing huge growth and interest from luxury travellers at the moment would be Japan. And a lot of that is due to the investment by a number of hotels because of the Rugby World Cup being held there in September and the Olympics next year. So there's been a number of hotels sort of ranging from things like the five-star beach resorts, but also the Ace Hotel Group, which is sort of known for its cool ethos, is launching its first property in Kyoto, and that's incorporating a former telephone office, and that's launching at the end of the year.
Okay, that'd be interesting.
Absolutely, it will be, and you can actually read about a lot more of those places opening in Japan in our latest issue as well.
Is it only places that people are interested in, or are they sort of into experiences? Would they go to a destination maybe that isn't quite as fantastic, but it's got this terrific experience that they can undertake? Is that part of the scene?
Absolutely, and increasingly growing. So we're seeing new buzzwords like Luxpedition, which is basically where people are wanting a luxury travel experience. So, you know, whether it's how they get there or where they're staying, but they also are really keen on adventures which immerse them in the culture and the nature. So basically things like, it's not commercialized group experiences, it's things that are more bespoke.
Right.
So it might be something like in central Vietnam, in Anantara's new property there, Quy Nhon, you can actually visit the house of a fifth generation local and learn about hat weaving or share a home cooked meal. So things like that. Equally, I guess in places like Rwanda, where you can stay like at the one and only, you can go trekking with native wildlife and chimpanzees and that sort of thing. So it's about going somewhere where you can have an expedition or an experience and an adventure, but it has a luxury twist. And that's something that we're certainly seeing increasingly in demand as far as luxury travellers go.
And would that also include some of the expedition cruise options that are available and becoming more available?
Absolutely, and the cruise companies are increasingly looking at their ports and how they can offer truly authentic experiences, so things that and take people to places that really are untouched, and we're seeing a lot of growth in that area.
Mm. The dollar becomes less of an issue at that point because this is a once-in-a-lifetime scenario.
Yes, I mean, it really is, and a lot of those, apart from, you know, cruising, there's a lot of expeditions or things that people, luxpeditions that people can partake in, which aren't particularly overly expensive, but I guess it's about, you know, that immersion and particularly the cultural immersion that's becoming really important. People don't want just to stand back and watch some sort of cultural performance. They want to actually feel like they're involved. So right. It's about having a really active kind of involvement and participation rather than just sitting on the sidelines.
Now, is there a particular age group that this concept appeals to, or does it work across the ages?
No, definitely covers across the ages. That's something that's definitely of interest from our readers across, definitely spans the ages.
I was wondering whether you might have multi-generational families involved in some of these experiences. You might have the millennial, but you might have the boomer couple, say that's the grandparents, and the millennials have got the young kids.
Definitely, and multi-generational travel is something that's increasing, and more and more people are looking for experiences that they can have with their adult children, and equally, you know, the grandparents can come along with the parents and younger children. So it's something that we're seeing that definitely spans the generations.
As a boomer, I get a bit suspicious that I might be there as a babysitter.
I'm sure there's that.
Oh, I'm sure there is. The other element of the whole equation, I guess, is the types of accommodation people are interested in experiencing these days. The straight hotel room doesn't quite cut it anymore, does it?
It definitely doesn't. And we're seeing a huge trend in this area. So here in Australia, there's people like Overlow Hotels who have got just incredibly really unique properties, and they've all got really different feels. So that's sort of, I guess, a good example of the evolution of the industry and where they're going. So in Woolloomooloo in Sydney, for instance, there's one of their properties is in a heritage-listed former wharf, and it's really got a really industrial feel, but it's done in a way that it just feels really, really cool. And there's sort of fairy lights everywhere and lots of little nooks and crannies to sit around and have a drink. I stayed there not so long ago, and it was definitely one of the coolest hotels I've stayed in. And they really know how to cater to their clientele. So you get your free mini bar and there's free in-room snacks, and you even get free yoga mats in there.
Okay.
It's a luxury hotel. It's got the rooms are stunning. It's beautiful, but it's done in a way that they've put a real twist on this heritage building, and it's something a little bit different. And people are also seeking things like to the other real extremes, like things like treehouse stays. We've seen a growth in bubble tents, and even locally there's now huge wine barrels you can stay in. Well, actually all over the world you can stay in huge wine barrels. And then closer to home there's the pop-up converted shipping containers, which have just been launched in Gippsland and King Valley and Masson wine regions in Victoria. And other things like overwater bungalows, which were incredibly popular and still are very popular, but actually now underwater rooms has really been on the rise. And there are a lot of underwater, not just rooms, but living rooms and places you can go and spend extended periods of time where you're literally in sort of your own aquarium.
Mm.
And I mean, there's been that sort of pushed the rise in people like hostunusual.com, who just have this amazing list of the most bizarre luxury properties you can imagine. So they've got things from castles to converted planes, and it's all broken down into literally, you can either break it down by region or by the type of accommodation you want to stay in. So they have got thousands of just really unique, strange properties that people can stay in. And that's clearly the popularity of that's been driven by demand. So we're saying people just wanting something a little bit different. And a lot of that is probably driven also by people wanting to go away on holiday and being able to share their experiences on social media or being able to show something a little bit different and in photography when they you know, just share it with their friends.
So if it's not Instagrammable, it may not be on their bucket list.
For some people, that's certainly the case.
It's interesting, isn't it?
It is. There's still people that want those stunning heritage properties. And look at Singapore, a Raffles Singapore. That's just the most incredible renovation they've just recently done, and a really stunning property that clearly has a really established core audience and will obviously maintain and grow that. But equally, there's just room in the market. I think people, you know, as people increasingly travel more and travel to different places around the world and have different experiences, there's room in the market for those types of people too, who are just seeking something a little bit different.
Well, it all sounds exciting. Every day must deliver to you something wow factor as to how people are trying to offer luxury to the traveller who's maybe just weary of the plain vanilla holiday and stay. Anyway, great to speak with you again, Kirsty, and the magazine's going well, I hear.
It's going really well. Really pleased at Grin Creative. We've got a number of magazines that we do. Really thrilled with the response we've had.
Sounds fabulous. Thanks again, Kirsty.
Thank you, Graham.
And that segment came to you courtesy of Travel Writers Radio in Melbourne. Next on the show, Travel Bites host David Gordon, all the way from Northern Ireland, visiting the Czech Republic, where he meets Neil from Eating Europe Tours.
So we're here in Prague, in the Czech Republic, and we're here with Neil from Eating Europe Food Tours. And I guess Eating Europe, they do exactly what they say on the tin.
Yeah, they do, I would say so. Eating Europe was started in 2011 by an American gentleman called Kenny, who set up in Italy. Now, Prague came about in 2014 when Jan Matsuk, the manager at the time, he had an interview with Kenny because he was actually a food journalist for an English writing newspaper. And he kind of fell in love with the idea of becoming a food tour guide, and he set up the company. He set up the first initial places and the first initial tours and runs. I myself came into the company about 2 years later, but I've been in it for about 2.5 years, constantly getting good reviews on TripAdvisor and stuff.
That's
so,
the main thing, that's a good thing.
Yeah, yeah.
The tours, I mean, you do, I always think it's better to go off the tourist trail slightly. So you guys actually bring people off the tourist trail to where locals go?
No, absolutely. I like to take people out of what I affectionately call Czech Disneyland as soon as possible, because you find that in the Czech Republic, as in many other tourist spots, there's going to be an exorbitant amount of price attached to restaurants within the main tourist catchment area. So what we do is we try and provide real Czech experience. We take you to places where everyday Czech people go to. So you kind of come away with a different experience, because if you just come here and just have the tourist stuff, you go away thinking that all we do is eat meat and potatoes and sell matryoshka dolls. And in reality, the Czech Republic, there's so much more to it. And we like to help explore that.
And of course, the other side of that is, as well as taking people to the local restaurants, they actually get to see and hear about the history of the city as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is something that I do with my guys, because if you really, you can't give people food upon food upon food upon food, right? Everyone's going to start feeling uncomfortable. So what we do is we take people out for small snacky stuff at first, and then as that kind of progresses, I will take them for a walk, and that's when I tell them about the history of the country. I try and kind of steer away from the kind of medieval side of stuff that everyone seems to associate with Prague, because to me, the last maybe 100 years since the First Republic was established, this is the main factors in how Czechs live their lives and who they are kind of culturally today.
The tours here in Prague, you have a couple of different tours on offer, a daytime and an evening time. Tell us about the difference between the two.
Well, they're in different areas. First of all, the daytime tour is more kind of around the skirts of Old Town and New Town. This is a lot more kind of family friendly. We kind of push this one for families a little bit more because there's a bit less alcohol involved. The evening tour, there's a few drinks, there's some wine tasting and stuff like that. You know, as you know about the Moravian wine experience, we also try and kind of encompass this. So, like, that's the main differences between them, location and also really market, I guess.
And the standout places for you in Prague, places to go?
there's so many, particularly the ones in our tour that I am very, very much in love with. There's a little place in our daytime tour called Špejle. And Špejle is a modern kind of Czech tapas restaurant, right? So what they've done is they've taken Czech food and dishes, kind of shrunk them down, and you go there. You tell the waiter that you're there, you order your drink, and then you just go help yourself to whatever food you like. Now, this is kind of strange for Czech people. They're usually very conservative, but it's a really smart way to introduce international cuisine to Czech people. Because it's in a smaller portion, they don't feel so overwhelmed, and they can go with it. And it's also good to show, like, the tourists that there is alternative options than just the general Czech food, you know, the massive duck leg, the big pork knuckle, that there are different ways to eat. So Špejle is one of my standout places.
Yes, we're here at the moment as well, which you brought us to today, a Vietnamese coffee shop, which my first time having Vietnamese coffee, and it's stunning, I have it.
Well, the reason that I brought you here is to show you that there are many multifaceted sides of Prague, and in fact, they have a massive Vietnamese population that's kind of like almost like this little secret. They came over in the 1950s to do all the terrible factory work that the Czechs didn't want to do, but they were very smart. Basically, they saved all of their money through the generations, and now they own pretty much every single independent grocery store in the Republic, and they also have these nice little cafes. So I thought, considering you'll be going around a lot of traditional Czech places, it might be nice to try something different.
It certainly was, and very nice as well. If people want to find out more and maybe book one of the tours with you, what's the website they need to go to?
The website that they need to go to, you can go through eatingeurope.com, or you can go through www.eatingprague.com as well. Either will take you there.
Thanks very much for your time today.
More than welcome. Thank
you. There's a recommendation for you. If you want to visit Prague, just have eatingeurope.com.
News and features from around Australia and around the world. This is Travel Radio Australia.
David Gordon reporting from the Czech Republic. And finally on the show, here's Arthur von Wieseberger with the Around the World Travel Radio team. And he chats with his mate Richard Torren about their recent trip to Barcelona in Spain.
Because we got Richard Torren on the air with us, and we're going to Barcelona, or Barcelona. You gotta have a lift, right, Richard? With? Can you lift it?
Buenos dias.
Buenos tardes, or whatever time it might be, wherever you are watching. Richard, it was such a great time going to Spain with you, and besides our wonderful travels to the ski area, we got to spend some time in the beautiful city of Barcelona. Had you been there before, Richard?
I'd never been there before. I'd passed through on a number of occasions, but never stopped.
So were you surprised by what you saw?
I wasn't just surprised, Arthur, I was riveted. It was far and away the most intoxicating city I've visited for a long time.
Wow, that's pretty impressive, because you travel a lot.
Yes.
I mean, we arrived, we came in by a car and driver from the mountains, and we arrived at the hotel called Casa Fuster.
Casa Fuster,
which is just off of the Avenue Diagonal, which is one of the main streets that goes through the middle of Barcelona. And it is a beautiful old private home.
It's a private residence.
Yeah, it was built in 1908. It was a gift from Senor Fuster to his wife, which was a very nice gift. And unfortunately, the guy went bankrupt and at some point.
How big was it?
These sort of things continue.
Yeah, well, it was a very big house, and I think they had to start renting out the top floors and the middle floors, and then ultimately it became a number of other things. I think it was a bank at one time. And then in 2000, it was taken over by Hotels Center chain. It's a group of hotels, and they did a complete renovation, top to bottom, and opened it in 2004. And it is a 4-star hotel with, I think, a 5-star added, a 5-star ambiance. Don't you think?
5-star attitude, 5-star amenities. And one of the things that totally blew me away was A, how hospitable the local people were, how welcoming, and the quality of the goods and services they produced was just terrific.
Yeah. I mean, this just going back to the hotel, one of the things I noticed, I was in a room that was so quiet and so comfortable, and, you know, one of those, you can make it really dark, which I liked.
That, yeah.
And the bathroom was filled with, you know, those little hotel soaps and stuff, shampoos and all that. It was all from Chopard.
Wow.
Which I didn't know Chopard was in the soap
I thought they
business.
Were jewelry.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. That's pretty impressive.
It was pretty nice. I kept every day taking a few, put it in my bag, take them with me. Anyway, so then Richard and I, we went out. Our first dinner in Barcelona was at a restaurant called Bota Fumero. Am I saying that right? Bota Fumero?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So, Richard, we were told it was about the best seafood restaurant in Barcelona. And tell us what it was like walking in there.
Well, I mean, again, it was elegant. It was an old-style restaurant. Waiters and waitresses traditionally dressed. Again, the standards of cuisine, the paella, the local dishes, were exemplary. One of the things which is very interesting is that dinner doesn't begin until people have gone to bed in California. You go out at 10 p.m. for dinner, and at 12 or 1 o'clock, the joint is full. Quite extraordinary. And at 1 a.m., Barcelona is on fire.
Yeah. It is.
It's Santa Barbara, really.
Yeah. Well, and you had, I think you guys had the paella, didn't you? I had the langoustine,
yes.
Which was delicious.
Yes.
And I thought, I mean, this was probably our most expensive meal in the entire time we were in Spain, don't you think?
Absolutely.
But it was still a good value for what we had. And by the way, the walls were covered with celebrities. There was Richard Torn.
There was Arthur von Weisenberg.
No, there was Morgan Freeman, which I was thrilled to see him on the wall. Anyway,
I think Bill Clinton too.
Yeah, you saw Bill Clinton, and of course our great president.
Yes.
Trump.
Yes. Huh? He's everywhere. Anyway, that was a great dinner, and then. And by the way, I think it opened, well, I forget how long ago it opened. It's been around a long, long time, though. It's a real classic restaurant. And then we went to Siete Puertas.
Yes.
It's seven doors. Yeah. And that's
and that was 100 years old.
And that was open, actually, older than that. It opened in 1836.
Oh, my goodness.
That restaurant. It was the first building in all of Barcelona to have hot water. Can you imagine?
Yeah.
Not back in 1836, it didn't.
Well, at some point, they had hot water, and whenever they brought it in. And they also had paella. But what I really liked there most of all was the black chocolate mousse. Oh, my God. It was so good. So that was another good meal. So then,
and how were the prices there? Pretty decent.
You know, it was normal, don't you think?
Yes.
Yeah. So then... We did some touring. We had to do touring because we're in Barcelona for the first time. And we went to go see Sagrada Familia. You know what Sagrada Familia is?
It's something family.
No. Yeah. Well, Richard, why don't you tell us what it is?
Well, it's the most extraordinary cathedral in the world. It was designed at the end of the 19th century. And they're still building it.
Yeah.
That's what's extraordinary.
It was actually Gaudi's. Life
Gaudi's
work.
Masterpiece.
Yeah, Antonio Gaudi built this with incredible. It's actually a Gothic style of architecture.
Neo-Gothic.
They love their cathedrals there.
And they said it's like the most impressive Gothic structure since the Middle Ages. And it's not finished. They started it in 1890-something. They started a long time ago, and they project it's going to be done by 2026, I think.
Well, you know, Arthur, everything in Spain is mañana.
Yeah, I guess that is really mañana. Yeah, it was started in 1882. And by the way, if you're wondering, where did Gaudi go? First of all, Gaudi died at the age of 73. Pretty young, I would say. But you know how he died?
No.
He was run down by a tram. I don't mean to laugh, but yeah, he was run down by a tram. Anyway, he's in the crypt underneath the church.
Yes, he is.
Which is, I thought that was only reserved for saints and popes and stuff, but I guess if you're the guy who built it, maybe you get special
preferential burial.
Yeah. Beautiful building, though. And
I think the most impressive thing is that, I mean, the wide avenues, the fact that it wasn't overcrowded, the fact that it seemed fairly relaxed, of course, the topography with the hills behind and the beaches in front is just fabulous.
Yeah.
It was a revelation and a city I'd love to go back and spend another weekend.
Do you remember when we walked in the church and there was this organ music playing and then this light coming in through all the stained glass?
Yes.
That was almost, I mean, it's about as close to a religious experience as I think you can get in a church. It was pretty impressive.
Yes.
And then someone said, now tell us where we are, Alex. We also went down to Las Ramblas, remember?
Yes.
And that's kind of a touristy place that you got to keep your eye on your wallet because of the gypsies. You know, be careful. But there is a wonderful open market there with fresh vegetables and fruits and seafood,
cheeses,
and everything. Yeah. And I got some olives there that were some of the best tasting olives I've ever had. That was down in the
What was the temperature and weather?
It was
like
it was in the 60s. Yeah,
60s. It was very
so people weren't at the beach though, really.
I didn't go to the beach. Did you go to the beach, Richard?
No, I did not go to the beach. No. We have beach in California.
Yeah. we didn't need to see the beach, but we saw a lot of great stuff, just hanging out there. It's a beautiful city, and there's all these different areas. There's the Gothic Quarter where we walked through that as well. It's a great walking city, actually.
Yes. Yeah. And once again, to emphasize, they welcome tourists. People were so friendly, and the levels of service were just exemplary. I was really, really impressed. Wherever you went, people were polite and friendly, happy to see you, and the quality of everything we ordered in terms of food was just terrific and not expensive.
Yeah. The one thing I noticed when we were in Malaga is that they're very, very family-oriented, and even if it is 10 o'clock at night when you're going out to dinner, like three generations of a family will be out with their young kids for dinner. Is that the case in Barcelona?
Remember when we were at Siete Portas, there were little kids there at midnight and 1 o'clock.
Oh, yes.
And you go, this is a different kind of life. But, I mean,
they do take naps, don't they?
They take naps, and then they go out. I mean, when we went to the airport, which I don't know about you, but when I went to the airport early morning that last day, like I left at the hotel around 5:30, or 5:45, there were people on the street just coming in from being out all night.
Yes. Not us.
No, not us. We were in bed well before the clock struck 10. We could.
Yes.
Great destination, though. Highly recommend it. And Richard, always a pleasure to have you on board. Thanks for joining us there.
My great pleasure.
And hopefully we'll go traveling again soon together.
It was a wonderful trip.
All the best.
See you, Richard.
Bye, Richard.
And that's it for another edition of Travel Radio Australia. Thank you to Jeff Harrison, Graham Kemlow, David Gordon and Arthur von Wiesenberger and Martha Ball, all featuring in the program this month. We'll have another show for you next month. Until then, I'm Renz Weirs, wishing you all happy trails.